Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. Good morning to all of you. I am Mike Pertle from Omaha. We are pleased to be here today. We have four cases this morning, and we will have one tomorrow morning. This is the November panel of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. I'm pleased to be joined today on my right by retired Supreme Court Justice Michael McCormick, who has kindly agreed to pinch hit for us until we get a replacement for Judge Irwin, who retired on November 1st. To my left is Judge Brett Embody from Wahoo. The four cases this morning are being recorded on audio, and they will be posted to the court's website later in the week and available for your review. Because of that, I would just caution, especially in our juvenile cases or any case that might be sensitive with the parties' names or children's names, that you keep that in mind and just use first names if at all possible. With that, we will begin this morning's session. We will go in the order of the call that was listed and on our website. The first case is Hostetler versus First State Bank, Nebraska. You may approach. Counsel for appellant is ready. You may approach.
May it please the court, my name is Greg Wirt. I am here today on behalf of the appellant in this matter. This is a workers' compensation case. My client is First State Bank of Nebraska, the employer on the accident in question. Just to give a little background to set the stage, the appellee is a young lady named Lisa Hostetler. She worked as a bank teller and loan processor for my client. On April 5 of 2013, she was descending some stairs at the workplace, reading some documents, was distracted as a result of where she fell and landed rather hard on her backside or her conscious sacral region, the very bottom part of the spine. Now, this was not a surgical condition. Several surgeons looked at her. Could not be cured by surgery, so she had some conservative care, likely conservative care. In the end, she was left with some permanent impairment of function, was ranged from 3 to 5% of the body as a whole, but because her injury is to the level of the body as a whole, her permanent disability is not measured by the doctor's ratings of impairment, but rather by her loss of earning capacity, a general work disability as opposed to a doctor's functional impairment rating. The parties agreed upon Lisa Porter to serve as the vocational rehabilitation counselor in this case. And this Porter issued a number of reports, and that's fairly common in these cases where we have different doctor's opinions that might be supplied to her over time. You'll see a series of reports from Ms. Porter. She issued a couple of them when she was provided with some restrictions from the doctors by Paris. Keep in mind that loss of earning capacity is a somewhat complicated measure of disability determined by vocational rehabilitation experts for the most part. And there are a number of factors that go into that. But when it comes to the effects of an accident, the work restrictions are the primary factor in determining what that disability is. What can the individual no longer do in the workplace because of the injury sustained on the job? And this is oftentimes kind of, we have different doctors' opinions on what those restrictions ought to be. Where the trial judges pass differing medical opinions, find the one that seems most logical to the trial judge and award benefits accordingly. In this case, the Honorable Maureen Van Norman, Nebraska Compensation Court judge, who tried the case with her client, decided to adopt the restrictions from Dr. Ty Paris. Those were the most stringent restrictions. And the key to what he was recommending was a four-hour work day. Every other physician testified with a better work a full 8 hours a day. We're working with a decision here that's premised upon that four-hour work day. My client's not asking you to go back and take a look at medical restrictions. We recognize that standard review here is such that we're going to talk about what is the effect of that four-hour work restriction assigned by Dr. Piperis. Judge Van Norman concluded that it resulted in permanent employment stone. The issue before you today are whether or not that was the correct conclusion, given what is, in essence, an undisputed set of facts. Ms. Hostetler has been working in this particular bank for 16 years. There have been a series of owners. The example shows four different groups owned the bank, but she continued to work there. She was skilled, she was trusted, she was a hard worker, and she had skills that were not only valued at that bank, but were transferable.
It appeared to me that the employer was very accommodating in this situation where a lot of employers wouldn't be. What guarantee was there that that would continue into the future?
There are no guarantees, Your Honor. But what we do know is that she had special skills. She was a loan officer. There's evidence suggesting that she stayed on because she had those skills, because the bank valued those skills. And there's no reason to think a new owner would not value them, whether that's some other owner in the general employment workplace would not value the same skills. Nor is there any evidence to suggest that she must work 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, in order to hold a job in this field. And in fact, the evidence shows that she was doing just to the contrary. The evidence actually shows that for a time after her injury, she continued to work.
4 hours a day, what she considers full-time employee and retired with well, health insurance and all those kind of benefits?
No, presenting the record. There's actually some conflicting evidence in the record on that. She testified at trial, Ms. Hostetler testified at trial, that she no longer had her insurance benefits, that she was paying more than she used to for the benefits. She still had some benefits, and she had to pay more than she had before when she was full-time. Ms. Porter's record showed that she was still receiving some health benefits to the job. So I think the evidence would show that there was a variance in that, and that would be a factor in her compensation package as a whole. It changed a bit because of her going to a part-time status. For a time after the accident, she worked a full 7 hours a day until Dr. Piperis, more than a year later, recommended a four-hour work restriction. At that point, my client accommodated, and she began working 4 hours a day, 5 days a week, and did it consistently. And in fact, she was still doing that at the time of trial. So the question is a 20-hour work week doing a very specialized job, earning $17 an hour, which translates to about $17,000 a year at a minimum, is that the equivalent of permanent and total disability? My client doesn't think so. We talk about what is the definition of permanent and total disability. There are only two issues I want you to focus on today, Judge. I'm going to talk about first, which is simply whether or not the award of permanent total disability was clearly wrong in this set of facts, whether or not there was evidence to support that in the record. We have various definitions of permanent total disability that recur in the case. One of them says that permanent total disability contemplates the inability of the worker to perform any work that she has experience or capacity to perform. Clearly, that definition does not fit you. She continued to perform the work she had been doing for 16 years. She retained the capacity to be a bank teller and loan officer at this very employer. That definition does not cause her to be permanently totally disabled. She was determined to be on lock. An on lock worker can still have some skills, can still earn some wage, but he's so disabled that no gainful employment can be maintained. And that's sort of a summary of the definition, but I can be more specific. Case law tells us that it does not mean a state of absolute helplessness, but means disablement of an employee to earn wages in the same kind of work, or work of a similar nature that she was trained for or accustomed to perform, or any other kind of work with subversion of her mentality and attainments could do. Again, if you apply that definition to the set of facts, she's not permanently totally disabled. She retains the capacity to earn wages in the same kind of work that she was doing before. It's not the same way. She has a loss of earning capacity, but that's a permanent and partial disability, not permanent and total disability. I think when you take a look at all the facts, you're going to see that she retains some very specialized skills. Lisa Porter, the vocational counselor here, had done an analysis of her transferable job skills. This is something vocational counselors do. If they were not working for this employer, could they take the skills they have and leave somewhere else to find work? And the answer is yes. We talk about occupational titles. Dictionary of occupational titles is oftentimes used on the pre-ed field. That's not referring to a specific job, but a series of jobs. That's really one title.
Ms. Porter concluded that Ms. Hostetler has the ability to perform work in 25 different DOT cab codes. She's got some real skills that can be transferred
with the four-hour limitation.
Again, there's no evidence that she cannot perform work of a specialized nature unless on a full-time basis. She's working part-time at the bank now, doing this work as paperwork, sedentary. Her restriction.
If she in fact has the four-hour limitation, then all of that is not open.
The four-hour limitation doesn't prevent her from doing what she's doing for this employer or any other employer. This is a sedentary job. Her restriction, besides the
question, can you go out and find a four-hour day job?
I think the answer is yes.
There's no evidence. Did you put on evidence for that effect? Did you have any evidence to show that there were some worse positions in the available marketplace?
No, that evidence is not evidence.
Didn't Ms. Porter determine from doctor's report that she was not modeling for purposes of determining her work?
Ms. Porter believed she could not work more than 5 hours a day. There is evidence in the record, and this was noted by the trial judge, that she has a very self-limiting view of her own abilities, and she chose not to pursue some psychological care that might have helped to see her way to a better capacity at work. She didn't do that. I'm almost out of time. I want to go quickly to my second point, and it's a real easy one. There's a court rule in Nebraska which says that the parties are not to do anything to attempt to influence or control the outcome of an occupational rehabilitation assessment, such as Ms. Porter performed in this case. The first time that Ms. Porter saw the report of Dr. Piperis and saw that he assigned a four-hour work restriction, she concluded that this resulted in only a 50-60% loss of earning capacity, permanent and partial disability. So there is that evidence for that evidence that she's not permanently totally disabled before our work restrictions. After she assigned that, or issued that report, that finding, counsel for Ms. Hostetler sent a letter basically saying, you're wrong, it ought to be permanent total, and she corresponded in kind and made that finding.
I'm sorry. Appreciate you being here. You're out of time. So that was 10 minutes, is that correct? Okay.
Thank you
very much.
Morning. Please join me, Mr. McMiner, on behalf of the appellee, Ms. Hostetler. I want to start off with a couple of issues with regards to the facts as they were presented by the appellant. I think a couple of errors that will segue into the actual assignments of error in this matter. First of all, the appellant has gone to length to impugn that Ms. Hostetler, in fact, was able to work 7 hours a day without any problems for a very long period of time, almost right up until the time of trial, cited in court, and ended up prepared to put her at 4 hours a day. That's not accurate. The injury happened in April of 2013, and Ms. Hostetler, from April of 2013 to June of 2014, went to 3 different orthopedic surgeons, and it was a displaced fracture of her coccyx. And it was such a rare injury, as Dr. Reba, one of her patients in Nebraska sports medicine, indicated, that it just was not operable. He referred her to Dr. Cornett, who also said surgery would not make it better. During that time period, she's being treated by various pain management doctors. She is at the point of June of 2014, suicide. That is in the UMC records for Dr. Cornett. The woman is at her wit's end with problems that she's experiencing. She's unable to function at work, in her home life, with a marriage, with her children. She's making mistakes at work as a loan officer, and Dr. Cornett takes her off for an entire month. He says this woman needs a break from June until July, and refers her to Dr. Paris to see if he can get a fresh set of eyes on her for pain management purposes, to see if something else can be done to help with her symptoms. Dr. Paris takes a couple of months to get in to see him. Once he sees her, it takes several months for him to adjust her medications, attempt spinal cord stimulator, morphine pumps, and other modalities to try and treat her symptoms, before he comes to the realization that her work, the time spent at work, is aggravating her symptoms and her injury, that we need to reduce the time. And so he reduces it to January of 2015 to 4 hours a day. And it stays that way until the time of trial, nearly a year later. He's the only treating physician from the summer of 2014 through the time of trial. That's the opinion that Judge Ann Norman relied on. Dr. Cornett, who had seen Mrs. Hostetler one time, was the only other treating physician that dealt with the FCE, and did so after only treating her one time and prior to and without any knowledge about Paris's continued treatment for nearly a year and a half prior to trial, where he had also reduced her to a four-hour work day. And at that time, she was able to go to work and do something and be able to interact with her family better than before.
Those four hours had a positive effect.
It did. It allowed her to be able to at least do something. Now, that puts us to the other issue of fact. I would ask that the court please look at the letter that I wrote to the vote counselor at Exhibit 24, as opposed to reading the appellant's brief version where they misquoted quite badly. There's a lot of clerical and grammatical error in it. I think it takes away from the meaning to what was actually asked from the vote counselor. There were two questions that were asked. The vote counselor was asked a question of whether or not 4 hours a day constituted reasonable gainful employment by definition. If so, please explain. And if not, then does by the very definition, which she also considers as a possibility, an odd lot worker. Ms. Porter, after being faced with those questions, had to admit, yes. It did not meet reasonable gainful employment, and by that definition, she could be considered under that scenario an odd lot worker. And whether or not she's current total is an issue to the trier of fact, the way all of the evidence is presented at the time of trial. Now, the assignment of error that was made by the appellant was whether or not a employee could, in fact, influence the vote counselor. Well, Rule 42E specifically excludes employees. It says all parties except for the employee may not attempt to influence the opinion of the vote counselor or the time and place of the meeting for the loss of earning power evaluation. It's specifically excluded. Because why? Because it's the burden of proof of the employee in these proceedings. It's our job to try and influence and give the information to the vote counselor. But what I would argue, though, to this court is that even if the court wants to input some level of restraint to the employee and say, look, you can't undo the influence, you may be able to influence, you can't undo the influence, or attempt to bias the vote counselor. And that wasn't done here. The questions that were asked of the vote counselor or the agreed upon vote counselor were acceptable, probative, relevant questions that would have been allowed over objection at the time of trial had we had to subpoena the vote counselor to answer those same questions and explain herself to the court. And in fact, because of that, Rule 10, because we were able to get to the bottom of the issue with written reports, and we were able to reduce the time and expense by having to have the vote counselors in this matter, both the rebuttal and the agreed upon, testify live at trial. Which is what we would have had to have done had we not been able to ask those questions of Ms. Porter, and or had Ms. Porter answered in the negative and said, hey, no, it's not. It is reasonable gainful employment.
What was the only objection at trial to my report, the supplemental report from Ms. Porter, was that it violated Rule 22E? Was that the basis of the objection?
Yes.
There was no other foundational objection or anything like that.
Oh, to my memory, I do not believe that there was a foundational objection. No, I don't. And that takes us to the second assignment of error that was by the appellant, and that is that it was judicial error to find that there was a perm total status for Ms. Hostetler. Judge Van Norman did a very good job in analyzing the evidence. She was presented with an agreed-upon counselor's opinion that, in fact, Ms. Hostetler could be looked at under Dr. Harris's restrictions as an odd lot worker and permanent holder. She was given an additional vote counselor's report by Patricia Conway, who did analyze in her report that Ms. Hostetler was lose 100% of the market or marketability to full-time employment as a loan officer and could not be employed full-time. And she found that she fit the criteria for odd lot worker under this restriction of Dr. Harris. Judge Van Norman listened to Ms. Hostetler's testimony. She weighed all of the medical evidence. She looked at all the doctor's opinions. And she went through the factors in both Schlup and Mata in detail. And she indicated that, hey, yeah, this bank is accommodating her, but it's changed ownership four times in the last 16 years. There's no indication that the next owner is going to be so accommodating, have a personal relationship like this one does with Ms. Hostetler. Other employers are, may not be so accommodating outside that, that particular employer. If she were having to go out and market her skills on a part-time basis to other banks, it's not that she's lost all access to the labor market, it's that she has lost all reasonable access to the labor market. She lives more than an hour, hour and a half from Lincoln. She can't drive more than 15 minutes at a time because of the jarring and the bumpiness of the road. That's one of her restrictions. And that was noted in her FCE that was adopted by Dr. Cornett as well. The fact that Ms. Hostetler was able to work from April of 2013, the date of the injury, to June of 2014 is a testament to her superhuman efforts at trying to overcome her handicap. And the evidence is clear in the medical record that this woman was having grave problems leading up until her time of meeting with Dr. Cornett when he took her off for a month in June because of her possible suicidal ideations and the pain and symptoms that she was having. She was trying to get through in her day, but this pain and the aggravation of the work of 7 hours a day was causing to her, her injury, what was too problematic for her. She couldn't consistently continue this for in the indefinite future for the rest of her life. And that was realized by her treatment providers and Dr. Paparis in reducing her work hours down to 4 hours a day. That's something that she was manageable with. And quite simply, 4 hours a day does not put her back to a reasonable gainful employment, and especially not where her position with the current employer is tenured. And it's not likely that she's going to be able to go out and find employment with other employers similar skill requiring or needing similar skills.
Was her hourly rate the same prior to her injury, or so just the hours were reduced for her?
Correct. Her hours were reduced. She was required to pay more money for her benefits to the point where most of the money was going to pay for her health insurance from her paycheck because of the increased cost. And she was doing that for her children so they would have health insurance.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted. We appreciate you being here, and we will have this under advisement. Thank you very much.